What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning into this episode of Eyewitness History. This episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Paul Gill Jr. Paul Gill Jr. is an author who's written a book called Armageddon in the Arctic Ocean. It tells the story of his father, Paul Gill Sr., who was a 22-year-old third mate on the Liberty ship SS Nathaniel Green, which sailed to Archangel and convoy PQ-18 in September of 1942. The book tells the story of his father's struggle to help support his large family during the dark days of the Great Depression, joining the Merchant Marine and making 8 passages to European ports as a 16-year-old, riding the rails across the United States in search of work in 1938, as well as the destruction of the Nathaniel Green off the coast of North Africa by U-565. The SS Nathaniel Green was one of just 9 merchant ships to be recognized as a gallant ship of World War II, which we definitely talk about. There's a plaque honoring these vessels and their crews in the American Merchant Marine Museum in Kingsport, New York. I really enjoyed speaking with him. He had a lot of great stories in the tradition of oral history passed down to him from his father, which we get into. And I think I'll leave it there. And now I give you Paul Gill Jr. Okay, I'm here with Paul Gill. Paul, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me, Josh.
Yeah, no, it's my pleasure. I'm excited to talk with you. I want to discuss you, I want to discuss your father, and I want to discuss your book, Armageddon in the Arctic Ocean. But before we do, Paul, please tell our listeners briefly who you are and what you do.
Well, I'm a retired physician. I practiced emergency medicine for 35 years. And since I retired about 10 years ago, I've been, busy doing a lot of things, primarily building boats and furniture. But for a couple of the last few years, I've been fulfilling the promise I made to my father shortly before he died to finish putting together his manuscript about his experiences growing up in the Great Depression era and his wartime combat experiences. That's consumed the majority of my free time since about 2020, I believe.
Excellent. Excellent, Paul. Thanks. So, let me just ask directly, what was it that prompted you to write the book?
Well, Josh, I'm going to make a slight correction. I didn't really write the book. My dad wrote the book.
Yeah.
Or at least most of the book. Health issues prevented him from finishing the book. He started writing when he retired in 1982 and got a lot of work done in the early stages of his life and also some chapters involving his combat experiences. But there's a few chapters that were in purely outline form, shall we say, accompanied by voluminous notes and correspondence. My dad was an incredibly fastidious note taker and record keeper. I literally have every union dues payment that he received starting at age 16 when he joined the National Maritime Union. I literally have all of that, every kind of certificate, say, documenting his passing, a lifeboat course, gunnery courses in preparation for convoy PQ-18. You name it. I even have menus of from the time he was in the Navy when there'd be, an officer's get-together, the menu for the shakedown cruise of the Nathaniel Green shortly before it was fully commissioned. So my job was to kind of flesh out some of the chapters my dad didn't finish writing, and to organize the whole thing. And I also had to come up with a new name because he wanted to, his working title was Red Waters. But as he got into the book, he realized he had a lot more to say than, a lot more to put down in writing other than for his wartime experiences. And he had some really amazing experiences as a young seaman going to Nazi Germany, to Hamburg. He made many trips as a 16 and 17-year-old. And then furthermore, Merchant Marine experiences and several months riding the rails from New York to San Francisco in 1938 when he was 18 years old. So I changed the name of the book to Armageddon in the Arctic Ocean. That title came from a statement he made in his diary at the time during the battle, when he said it was like Armageddon, the battle of good versus evil at the end of the world. I thought, oh, wow, that is a wonderful description of the combat that was going. It was all-out war. The German Luftwaffe and the U-boat are versus this convoy that was struggling to get to Archangel to deliver much-needed war material to the Russians. This was around time when the Battle of Stalingrad was really shaping up to be the pivotal battle. Most military historians would say it was the pivotal battle, certainly of the European war, but probably of the entire global war.
Yeah, absolutely, Paul. Thank you. So just to say it clearly, I suppose, for our listeners, what exactly was the Nathaniel Greene, the USS Nathaniel Greene? Sorry, let's say that one more time. Sorry.
Yeah, the Nathaniel Greene was a Liberty ship. Some of your listeners may be familiar with that category of ship. Over 2,000 of them were built during the war, actually 2,710. The Nathaniel Greene was number three. It was launched in January of 1942. And the Liberty ship was a ship that was put together in a modular fashion. The different modules were welded together rather than using traditional riveting techniques. This enabled the shipyards to crank out these ships very quickly. In fact, the average Liberty, after the program got started, after a year or two, they were basically producing a Liberty ship every 39 days.
Wow.
Which was essential because the transfer shipping of war material across the Atlantic to the British Isles and also to our Russian allies was critical. And the U-boats are in the early going, in the early stages of the Battle of the Atlantic, were destroying Allied shipping at a very scary rate. In fact, I think Winston Churchill said once that the only facet of the war that truly frightened him was the U-boat threat.
Yeah,
extraordinary. So the onset or the program to produce massive numbers of Liberty ships was a key element in the final Allied victory.
Wow. I had scrolled through, as an e-book copy, and and one phrase that kind of struck me, which I just wanted to throw at you and just get your thoughts on for our listeners. What is a gallant ship, Paul?
Well, yes. After the war, the U.S. government, the military establishment, and the merchant marine looked over the actions throughout the war in the various theaters, the actions of the merchant ships. And it was nine of these ships were found to have played especially important roles and had displayed singular gallantry. The Nathaniel Greene was one of the nine ships. Now, mind you, there were over 4,000 American merchant ships involved at various points during World War II. Nine were singled out as gallant ships, and plaques are placed in the museum at the United States Merchant Marine Academy at Kings Point. There's actually a room there containing the plaques to these nine vessels. And for wow. To go a little further, what I find fascinating is that Convoy PQ-18 was considered to be the biggest convoy battle of World War II by the British Admiralty. And the three merchant ships in that convoy awarded this gallant ship citation. Even more fascinating to me is that all these ships were all in a group. Nathaniel Greene was in one row, and the two other vessels in the convoy, the Virginia Dare and the William Moultrie, that were given the citation, were in the next row to starboard. And the reason that this group received these rewards was because they received the brunt of the repeated Luftwaffe air attacks. They came in from air bases in northern Norway, and naturally the first group of ships they would see in this vast convoy were those on the starboard side. It was my dad's ship, the Virginia Dare and the William Moultrie were all on the starboard side of the convoy. The first two rows of ships in that convoy were almost completely obliterated. And I think the Greene, the Virginia Dare, and the William Moultrie were just amongst the handful in the third and fourth column over that survived these repeated air attacks. And they fought back. Obviously, they fought back. They really gave it back to the Germans. These ships, they were merchant ships, but they were very heavily armored with big, they had a 4-inch gun on the bow and the stern section, as well as airlock gun, 20-millimeter anti-aircraft guns. and they were just bristling with 50 caliber Browning and 30 caliber machine gun. And the Green herself shot down 8 German aircraft during the convoy, during the 9 or 10 days of intense action. And that later one, as she was sinking in the Mediterranean, she shot down one more Heinkel 111 torpedo bomber. So, but all these ships had just brilliant records of gallantry during the times that they were exposed to intense enemy fire.
Wow. That's amazing. One question I'm sort of dying to ask you, you mentioned, your father was such a rigorous note taker, to put it mildly. And I'm just curious, as you were researching the book, Paul, was there anything that surprised you about your father that you didn't know previously?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. No, not really, Josh, because I was the only son. I had 4 sisters, but I was the only son. And as I learned much later in life, my dad never confided in my daughters. He never talked to them about his youthful experiences or his wartime experiences. I don't know why that was, but he and I spent a lot of time together renovating an old farmhouse when I was just a young teenager. And he'd take these long drives out from our home on the north shore of Long Island out to the far south, or the far east end of the island. And he found this a good time to just open up to me about some of his experiences, both at home growing up in South Boston and the Civilian Conservation Corps and the Merchant Marine. And then, of course, the convoy PQ-18, this tremendous experience when he was 28. He was the 22-year-old third mate on the ship. So, no, there was nothing really surprising. I think everything that probably most of the material in the book, at one time or another, my dad either spoke of in a general way or in a very specific way. And I'm blessed, like my father, with a very, very good memory, an eidetic or almost a photographic memory. So I can recall these stories, listening to them, some of the stories were so stunning to me. I can remember where we were. This is 60 years ago when he told me these stories, and my reaction was just, because some of the events were just mind-boggling.
Well, I have to jump in now then. I have to beg you for a story that he told you. By the way.
All right. Well, I'll give you a story about his experiences riding across the country, riding the rails, as they say, hoboing across the country with his older brother. Now, Dad was 18. Steve was, I think, about 4 years older. And the country at this point in the late 1930s was experiencing what they called the Second Great Depression. The economy had picked up rather well after FDR came into office and initiated his New Deal. But then when things started to stabilize a little bit, FDR listened to some of his more conservative advisors who felt that they should maybe tighten up the budget a little bit. And they did. Consequently, the economy went back into actually another Great Depression, starting around early 1938. So whereas my dad had no problem finding jobs aboard various American ships, those jobs dried up, and sure, only more senior seamen were able to find work. So he and his brother heard that there were plentiful jobs in Alaska. So they didn't have the money to, to actually buy a ticket on trains, but they figured we'll just ride the rails. So they did, and they got as far as Denver, Colorado. Steve kind of became disillusioned. They started to hear reports from other hobos that, yeah, we went up to Alaska to where supposedly there's a lot of jobs opening up in the Matanuska Valley. The federal government sponsored a colony. They relocated upper Midwestern farmers to the Matanuska Valley north of Anchorage and staked them to homes and, tried to get things going as far as a new farming community. It just didn't work out. So Steve got disillusioned. He had a little more experience, I'd say, than my dad. He thought he could find work on a ship. He went back to New York. Dad continued on. And this is where the trip really got exciting for Dad. When he got into Wyoming, he spent a night in a, he would do this often as a hobo. He knew if he reported to the local hoosegow, that very often the sheriff or the police would let him sleep in the jail overnight. So he did one night. The next morning he was eating breakfast, and the police officer said, do you know how to ride a horse? That's it. No, I grew up in Boston. I don't know how to ride a horse, but why? Why are you asking? He says, well, you know, it's that time of year. I think it was like September, and the ranchers, they're starting to bring their herds of sheep down from the mountains. They need extra help to bring supplies up and to help bring down the sheep. My dad said, well, I can learn how to ride real fast. So he became a sheep herder.
Wow.
He did that, I think, for about 3 or 4 weeks on the Continental Divide, and I believe it was Wyoming. So there's many more stories, but there's one for you.
I love it. I love it. No, yeah. Thank you, Paul. That is a story. I love it. You write in the book about your dad tracking down his best friend on the Nathaniel Green, radio man John McNally.
And yes.
Yeah, I just want to quote you quick and then get your thoughts. To quote you, the two old shipmates would sit for hours on our front porch and exchange stories about the good and the bad times they experienced on the SS Nathaniel Green. Whenever I could, I would sit quietly and listen to their enthralling stories, end quote. Now, I don't mean to play you like a jukebox, Paul, for all your stories.
Yeah.
But I'm just curious if there is one particular story that you heard on that porch that stood out more than others.
Yeah, there are a lot of good stories. Dad and John, it's kind of interesting that during the voyage, during their time together on the Green, they were best friends. They really were. Dad told me he looked up to John because John had a high school diploma. Dad had to leave school at age 15 to help support his family. So here's this man, a year or so older than him. It was John's first voyage, first time at sea. What an experience. I'm going to be a merchant mariner. His first voyage is to Archangel Russia. And he was the radio man participating in the most intense convoy battle of the war. At any rate, they did become good friends. And when they went into port, they would go out together to bars, just, socialize. And they were great friends. But one story that my dad told that John reminded Dad of, Dad didn't want to, blow his own horn, but John confirmed that during one period, I think it was the second day, the Luftwaffe started their bombing attacks on September 13th. And the night before, and they knew that, the stuff was going to hit the fan that day because they were getting that close to the coast of Norway that they would be within range of the Luftwaffe. And the night before, Dad had talked to the commander of the Naval Armed Guard on board. There were 25 or so trained naval seamen who were gunners. And Dad's specific job during action stations was to maintain a steady flow of ammunition to the guns on the stern section of the ship. And Lieutenant Billings assured Dad, we have 20,000 rounds of ammo ready to go. So don't worry. We won't have to worry about reloading during any action. Well, after about an hour of unremitting attacks, they were running out of ammo. So Dad collared three men, got three volunteers to go down to the magazine, which was in the stern of the ship, was three decks below down. Needless to say, not a very safe place to be in the midst of a bombing attack. But he got three men to go down there with him to load bullets into machine gun belts. And naturally, everybody was scared to death, including Dad. Said he was absolutely petrified, never thought he'd get out of that situation, because even a near miss could trigger an explosion. The whole ship could go up. But at any rate, to keep the men sort of focused, he led them in songs. They'd sing all kinds of songs, including the Battle Hymn of the Republic and, patriotic songs like that. And while they're down there, all of a sudden, there was a tremendous explosion. The ship, it was such a powerful explosion. Their ship was tilted way over, and they ran up to the deck. They thought they had been torpedoed. And actually, the Nathaniel Green had not been torpedoed at that time. However, the ship astern of them was no longer there. Dad said he looked aft to see what was going on, and there was just a cloud. That the ship that had been about 1,000 feet behind them in column had been hit and disappeared. Vapor.
Wow.
Basically. So that's a story that John and Dad talked about. John had a good view of it because he was, he was the radio operator. He was just outside the radio shack. Yeah, he just happened to be looking at the time.
Yeah. That's an amazing story, Paul. Thank you.
Yeah.
This might be an odd question, but I would like to ask it. What is it that you're looking for people to get out of the book?
What I'm looking for them to get is that during this time, and I'm speaking of the time between the onset of the Great Depression, 1929, And through to the end of World War II, there are a lot of really, really great, great people who otherwise would never have been challenged to display great courage and fortitude, endurance and patriotism. And my dad was lucky. He'd be the first person to tell you he was very fortunate that he survived his experiences, including his, you know, pre-war experiences, but then to be able to have the leisure time to sit down and pen the story, record his experiences. There are many, many others who died, who never made it through the war, never made it through the Great Depression or the war, who are very worthy of whatever accolades dad got. And he did receive several medals from the Soviet government and U.S. government as part of a, you know, a crew, a gallant crew. But what I would like to get people to come away with is that there were millions of American men and women who came through brilliantly in terms of their contribution to the war effort. And very few of them, percentage-wise, ever received any credit for what they did. But Tom Brokaw had it right when he talked about the greatest generation. There are just millions who were great patriots and never expected any sort of recognition for what they did. They just felt they did the right thing. My dad always said that his war experiences were searing and very traumatic, but he would do it again. And a similar word, he had very clear views on the Vietnam War, and I don't think that he would have been so willing to volunteer to engage in that sort of a conflict where the issues were not real clear. But as far as World War II, there's no question the country was quite literally under attack. And if it weren't for a whole generation of young men and women who stepped forward, we would not have come out on the winning side.
Yeah, no, that's true. I understand what you mean about the greatest generation. I've had the honor of interviewing actually a few World War II veterans, and they're a different breed, aren't they? They have a sense of duty that, no disrespect to my generation, but my generation just doesn't have. And maybe it is something as simple as we're confronted right now with a psychopathic mass murdering maniac who means to take over the world. If there was one thing that we could get behind as a culture and bond together on, surely it'd be that.
Yeah, the issues are much more clear-cut and back and white. I mean, just the very fact that Hitler, what he was, of course, we didn't fully understand everything that he was up to, but it was pretty clear he was invading other countries and, you know, starting a war that was completely unnecessary. He was a maniac. And then when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, well, there was absolutely no question that we were at war. We had to fight.
Yep.
We had to defend ourselves.
Yeah. No, it's interesting, not to drone on here, Paul, but so I interviewed a few World War II veterans and a few Vietnam veterans. And what struck me is both the World War II veterans, as I say, came at it with a sense of duty, and I would happily do it again. And, you know, proudest thing I've ever done in my life was that. When I talk with the Vietnam veterans, they have almost a sense of regret isn't quite the right word, but it was more a sense of, we're not quite sure why we did this. Why all the damage? Why all the death? And why do I still wake up screaming? You know, PTSD, of course. It's just an interesting thing to dichotomize.
Yeah, it's very sad. I mean, certainly my father-in-law was also a combat veteran of World War II. He fought in Europe, and he shared some stories with his sons that many years later shared with me. And they're just horrible situations he was put in, and I think it affected him for the rest of his life, truly. But at least fundamentally, I don't think any veterans return from that war wondering if they did the right thing or if their government put them, if their government was more in the morally, was morally correct for sending them to war. But with Vietnam, to say the least, there was a lot of moral ambiguity there that continues to, I think, trouble most of the veterans. I didn't serve in the military, but I have friends who served and were, you know, traumatized physically and morally. And none of them have ever said to me that they, boy, but it was, I'm glad I did that for my country because it was clearly the right thing to do. There's great murkiness about, you know, their thoughts about what they went through.
To say the least. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry for the tangent there, Paul.
That's fine.
Where can people get the book?
Well, they can get it at the website, the publisher's website, which is hellgatepress.com, or at Amazon. the book, it's a print on demand book, and Amazon is the printer and marketer. I didn't realize this until after the book came out, but you know, until we're very far into the process. But it's not in bookstores except for my local bookstore, but they'll have to go to either Amazon or Hellgate. Hellgate's actually a little bit cheaper at Hellgate. So I think it's $21.95 on Amazon. I think it's $19.95 on Hellgate. And there's lots of Hellgate specializes in combat in veterans memoirs. And they've got a lot of really good books in their catalog. So I would encourage people to, I've read a few of them and there's some good stories, particularly from Vietnam vets. Very interesting books available. So I would encourage visit to Hellgate. And the thing is, a lot of people have Amazon Prime, so they don't want to pay the postage. So I understand that.
Yeah. And I'll happily include links to all that in my show notes.
Okay,
here.
Thank you.
Yeah. My pleasure. Well, this has been great. Paul Gill, how can people find out about you, sir?
About me? Well, if they buy the book, if they go to the Hellgate Press website and look at the book, there's a little bio about Dad and me. You know, as I said, I'm just a retired physician. I never distinguished myself in the way that my father did and his generation mates did. But yeah, they'll find out what they need to know there.
Gotcha. Yeah, when it comes to comparing ourselves as the greatest generation, we're all just fighting for second place at that point.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Well, Paul, this has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time for me. This was great.
Well, thank you, Josh. It's been fun. I've really enjoyed it. And I thank you very much for inviting me to talk about my dad's book.
All right, Paul, you take care.
Okay, Josh, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. Thank you for taking the time to listen to it. Just a short announcement before we close out our time together. As many of you know, my show, Eyewitness History, is part of the Parthenon Podcast Network. That includes such shows as History Unplugged with Scott Rank, History of the Papacy with Steve Guerra, Key Battles of American History with James Early, and Richard Lim, who does This American President. I'm excited to share that we have a new show on the Parthenon Podcast Network, History of North America, hosted by Mark Vinette. It explores interesting, compelling, wonderful, and tragic stories of the North American continent, its inhabitants, its heroes, its villains, its leaders, its environment, and of course, its geography. Mark releases new episodes every week, but has more than 100 episodes that are about 15 minutes or less, that are all about the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, all available to stream right now. Just search History of North America on your favorite podcast app to start listening.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.